Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do U.S. voters really know about the inner workings of the Bush White House? 2 years after being asked to step down from his position, former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan is sharing an insider's perspective on a work culture that demanded loyalty as much to the administration and its goals as to the right of the American people to know what was going on. Scott McClellan spent nearly 3 years as White House Press Secretary before being replaced in 2006 by Tony Snow. And while McClellan's descriptions of President Bush typically portray a decent person without a specific intention to deceive the American people, top advisors, including Scooter Libby and Karl Rove, do not come across as so benign. McClellan's new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Scott, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks for having me on today. Glad to join everybody.
You describe a sort of permanent campaign mentality that pervaded the culture of the White House when you were there. Can you talk about the kind of tactics that are common when an administration is in campaign mode?
Sure, and it's something that has been going on for quite some time and building over the years, and certainly something that preceded us. But it was something that then Governor Bush, as he was running for president, essentially pledged to move the country beyond when he talked about being a uniter, not a divider. And what happens is that when the presidential campaign ends today, the campaigning never stops. In Texas, when he was governor, there's a clear line between the campaigning and governing. We worked across the aisle, but in Washington, in this day and age, it's all about this constant effort to try to shape or manipulate the media narrative to your advantage. And each party gets caught up in it to some extent, but that's the primary means for governing, as opposed to deliberation and compromise and reaching out across the aisle to forge consensus to solve the big problems. And that comes a distant second in this permanent campaign culture that exists today. But it's more the unsavory tactics that you see in a political campaign where it's focused on spin and manipulation, and that becomes an accepted norm within the culture here in Washington too often today. And it's one of the things that I think we need to change.
Whether they supported him for president or not, whether they still like him or not, many people here in Texas remember Governor George W. Bush as a really different sort of figure than the one who became president. You started working for Governor Bush when you were 30. Can you talk about the sort of figure that you saw and that you really wanted to attach your career to?
Sure, absolutely. And I think most of your listeners will remember, as I've been going across the country, I've had to remind people that this was a very popular bipartisan governor of Texas, whose approval ratings for much of his time in office were well above 70%, which is unheard of. But that's really what attracted me to him. I was an idealistic, young political guy who thought that we could bring that same sort of bipartisan spirit to Washington, D.C. The president had a record of working with, during his first term, the Democratic Lieutenant Governor, Bob Bullock, and the Speaker of the House, Pete Laney, both Democrats, and really getting things done for the people of Texas. And Bob Bullock certainly deserves plenty of credit because he said when the election season is over, the campaigning ends, and then it's time to do what's best for the state of Texas. Unfortunately, you have too few of the Bob Bullocks up in Washington, D.C., who are willing to stand up to the others that tend to get more of the voice in the media these days, which tend to be the more partisan voices on each side of the aisle.
What if you can talk about how your goals in the position and your values in what you did for a governor and then President Bush, especially given that you were so young when you began, were shaped by his expectations of you?
Was shaped by his expectations of me?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the expectations, as I came to learn, were certainly message discipline and recognizing that when he makes the decision that you're expected to help advance that decision and not question those policy decisions. But when I went to work for him, I had all this great hope that we could bring that same sort of bipartisan spirit to Washington. It didn't happen, and that's what the narrative really focused on in my book is how did things go so terribly off course for this presidency. But the expectations over time, as I saw in Washington, did not turn out the way that I thought they were at the beginning, probably. I knew when I became press secretary that there is a certain way the president expected things to be done from the communication standpoint. And I was concerned, after having served 2.5 years as the deputy White House press secretary, and I write about this in the book as well, I was a little bit concerned about whether or not I would have the kind of flexibility to do the job the way I wanted to do it. But I knew coming in July of 2003, that we were entering an election year and that people were not looking to change the way things were done. I made the decision to go forward with it. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There are many positive feelings I still have about the position, but it became more disillusioning over the last 10 months while I was press secretary, as certain things came to light, such as two former senior colleagues of mine knowingly misleading me in the Valerie Plame leak episode. As those things came to light, I became increasingly disillusioned about my time in Washington.
Scott, were you ever in a position to verify information that you were given to communicate? I mean, how often did it happen that you said, that doesn't seem to wash for me, and I want to go to another source and make sure that before I communicate information to the American people that I have the truth?
Well, you do play, as a press secretary, you do kind of become your own journalist with inside the White House, because you have to go and gather information to be able to report it back to the American people and provide accurate information to the American people. So to some extent, you have to rely on those around you. But I had, and this is one of the things I talk about as well, is I had full access to the president. I participated in the policy briefings. I participated in most world leader meetings, congressional meetings, cabinet meetings. But this White House is so internally compartmentalized, and by that I mean that some of the more consequential decisions might be made in a group of two or three people with the president. So sometimes, as press secretary, and this happened to myself as well as my predecessor and successors, sometimes as press secretary, I didn't understand the full driving motivation behind some of those decisions. Instead, I had to rely on those around me, and instead of hearing it firsthand at certain times. And that's a tough place for a spokesman to be in any time. And it's certainly a concern looking back on my time in the White House that I wish I would have addressed differently.
Did you see yourself first as a servant to the president and secondly, but perhaps without conflict, as a servant to the American people?
Well, I think sometimes that got clouded. Your first priority is to the American people above all. And I think with the book, I've shown that my ultimate priority rests with the American people and the truth. But as you get caught up in this Washington atmosphere, and particularly when you're inside the White House, you can tend to lose perspective on the bigger picture and what's going on around you. And that happens to a lot of people that come to Washington on both sides of the aisle. I think there are a lot of good people that come here for the right reasons to make a positive difference, and they get caught up in this Washington game of seeing who can manipulate the narrative to its advantage the most effectively. And the media holds up those who are up, do it most effectively, and tend to lionize those who do it most effectively, rather than focusing more on the on what's right and what's wrong and what's the underlying truth of some of these issues and games that are being played here in Washington that we continue to see in the presidential campaign even today.
Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan is my guest. His new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Very often, Scott, the president's critics will portray him as having been somewhat dominated by people in the administration, people like Karl Rove, even Vice President Cheney. Can you talk about the dynamic between them as you observed it?
Well, those are certainly two individuals, Karl Rove and the vice president, that had enormous influence on this president. And I think overall it was more negative than positive for both those individuals. And you only have to look at the end results and what's come to light in the final years of this presidency to come to that conclusion, I believe. But certainly in any White House, you're going to have a huge political operation in this modern political world that we live in. There was a huge political operation in this White House, and Karl Rove was the one who, of course, oversaw that. And whether or not the political advisor is going to be inside the White House or outside the White House, they're going to have a lot of influence over any president. And the point I make in the book is that you've got to have a counterweight to that influence. You've got to have a counterbalance to that influence. And we may have had some of it early on in the administration, but we didn't have a constant counterweight to that political influence. That was more focused on transparency and focused on reaching out across the aisle. And then in terms of the vice president, of course, he exerted enormous influence over particularly foreign policy, but also energy policy and some economic policy to some extent. And to some extent, all that was intertwined as well. But the president is the one that ultimately makes the decisions, and he has to bear responsibility for the decisions. But in terms of the vice president and even Secretary Rumsfeld, for that matter, the president, I believe, was too deferential at times, giving them too much authority to carry out policies the way they saw fit. A good example of that would be the vice president in being able to implement the energy policy or implement the detainee policy the way he largely saw fit. And the president wasn't involved in some of those details, but he allowed the vice president to go about it the way he saw best.
If he was too deferential, Scott, do you think that was a factor of his own lack of confidence?
You mean lack of confidence in himself?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. I think it was more, maybe to some extent, but I think it's more so this attitude that as president, he's got to stay focused on the big picture. He's got to surround himself with capable individuals who have experience and be able to trust them, this kind of CEO management style. And I think it was too much to one side for this president. You don't want to micromanage things, and you can't do that as president, but you certainly need to be involved in some of the details of those more consequential policy decisions than he was at times.
I want to talk about the buildup to the war in Iraq. You definitely had moments where you felt as though you weren't withholding, in other words, you weren't giving out information that was untrue, but you certainly were instructed to withhold certain elements of the information that was available to you.
Well, I was in, and just to remind your listeners, I was the deputy press secretary at the time, so my role in the build-up to the war was more limited. I did fill in for my predecessor at times as being the chief deputy press secretary. And like a lot of Americans, I was concerned about how quickly we were rushing into war in Iraq. I'm someone, from a moral standpoint, who believes we should not go to war unless it's absolutely necessary. And it's clear to me today that the Iraq war was not absolutely necessary. But at the time, like a lot of Americans, I was willing to give the president and his foreign policy team the benefit of the doubt. Today, I believe that that trust was misplaced and that the policy was misguided. There are other ways we could have gone about addressing the threat from Saddam Hussein. And he certainly wasn't the grave and gathering danger that we portrayed. But yes, at times I did go out there, and it was less of talking about withholding information rather than more of focusing on here's what makes the best case. My experience of sitting in on the White House Iraq Group meetings, and the White House Iraq Group was set up specifically to market the Iraq war to the American people, and then later it was used to continue the strategic communication side after the initial invasion. I participated in a couple of those meetings in the build-up to the war, and then I participated regularly in those meetings after the initial invasion. But there wasn't a group of people sitting around in the room sinisterly trying to say, let's go and mislead the American, how do we best mislead the American people to build support? Rather, it was focused on this idea, how do we make the most compelling case to the American people, much like you would do on selling a Social Security reform or education reform or tax cuts to the public. And that's where the permanent campaign culture becomes most troubling, when it's brought into the war-making process and we see how corrupting of an influence it can have on governance and policy when that happens. Because when you go to war, the American people need to know the truth of the situation as best the government knows it, and they need to know the risks and the costs and the consequences as best we know it at the time. And instead of giving them the full truth, we focused on giving them the most compelling case, dropping the caveats, dropping the qualifications, implying certain things by our rhetoric that turned out to be dubious or even false. At times when it became known later.
My guest is former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. His new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. We'll continue talking about the buildup to the Iraq War and the management of the war itself after the break. We will talk about the response to Hurricane Katrina, and we will take your calls at 1-800-933-5372. If you prefer, you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Scott McClellan, former White House press secretary, whose new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. You can join us via email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Was the concept of fear used as an element in selling the invasion of Iraq to the American people?
Sure it was, and if it wasn't used directly, it was certainly used by implication and innuendo at times. We were in this post-9/11 atmosphere, and I think a lot of Americans were concerned at the time about being attacked again. And one of the things that happened was, when we're trying to make this strong case, is that, you know, we took the biological and chemical weapon threat, which most people thought that he had some biological and chemical weapons, but then you start adding on the nuclear threat, and you start adding on contacts with Al-Qaeda, who, of course, we, you know, was responsible for 9/11, and it creates this sense that, and particularly in the aftermath of the anthrax attacks after 9/11, it builds upon that fear and makes the case more compelling, makes it sound more urgent, more serious, and more grave than it actually was. And, you know, at the time, I didn't have access. I wasn't seeing the intelligence. I wasn't, you know, that familiar with the regime's intentions. So I trusted what the information that was being provided, and I trusted the White House foreign policy team.
Did you have any role in preparing a sort of contingency plan to announce the need to take aggressive action against Iran while you were there?
Well, Iran was something that was always on the president's mind, at the top of the list of potential threats, and certainly when I was sitting in on world leader meetings in particular, and even some congressional meetings, it was a subject that always came up with the president, and one that the president continues to talk about, as we know, publicly. And one of the reasons why I felt it was important to write the book when I did, because I want to make sure we don't repeat the same mistakes. Rightly so, people are skeptical about some of the intentions there. Now, I'm one that believes that this president is pragmatic enough politically to know that there's nothing he can really do in terms of taking military action against Iran in the remaining months in office. Whether or not Israel intends to do something in the next few months is the big question, and that could certainly throw a wrinkle into the overall equation in the region and what other nations might do or have to do if Israel were to take action against Iran.
Let's talk about loyalty and what that really meant to President Bush and to the rest of the administration. You know, we have heard famously that was, you know, prized above almost everything else. And I'm wondering whether you were able to talk about some of the questions and concerns that you had with other coworkers sort of privately, or if it was something where you had to sort of suffer in silence and wonder if you were the only one who had these doubts.
Well, a couple of things there. One, the president's the type of person that he welcomes dissent when you're going through the policymaking process. I don't think he was exposed to enough diversity of views, and he's certainly not one that sits around engaging in a extended policy discussion about the various options that are available. He tends to govern more from the instinct. But once he makes that policy decision, he expects everybody to march in lockstep. You can question how you go about implementing the policy, but he does not want anyone questioning the policy decision once he has made it. And that's part of that also shows a certain lack of reflection that I think is needed in any president. Now, you can't have too much of it, but I think reflection and critiquing is very important, and questioning is very important even after you've made that decision. But that's not what he expected. And in terms of talking internally, again, in the build-up to the war, you know, there are probably some discussions I had with friends that, you know, I was wondering, well, we seem to be moving awfully quickly here, and they weren't involved with 9/11. But no, it was not something that was encouraged or something that, you know, you come into an environment like that, and there's almost a certain social conformity that goes along with it. Everybody's focused on doing their job that day and carrying out the president's wishes. And there is great loyalty to the president amongst his staff. He is a very likable person, a very charming person on one-on-one, and he's also very loyalty to the staff. But the ultimate loyalty, and this is one of the things I've talked about before, is there's this sense by some in Washington that loyalty to a particular office holder is more important than any other loyalty, and it's that kind of false loyalty which tends to have a corrupting influence on government at times. Because there's no more higher loyalty than the loyalty to the basic ideals we hold dear, such as candor and transparency and integrity, loyalty to the truth and loyalty to the American people. And that's what the highest loyalty is. And it's easy for people to lose sight of that higher loyalty at times when they're in Washington and serving a particular office holder. And I hope that by what I wrote in the book, people will be able to learn some lessons about what's most important and not repeat some of the mistakes that I made and others have made as well.
Scott, as a journalist, I'm aware that many people beyond the insular Bush White House consider reporters to be a distraction or a hindrance or even a sort of deliberately disruptive force when they're trying to work. But I have to wonder whether the disdain that we saw from the president and the vice president and some others for honest inquiries by journalists can be reasonably interpreted as disdain for the intelligence of the American people, a sort of mentality that said, just leave us alone. We know what we're doing. Please stop asking questions and let us get going.
Yeah, that's a fair question to ask. I mean, one of the things the president said repeatedly when he campaigned for president back in 2000, and I was serving as the traveling press secretary at the time, so I was with him on the road a lot, was that, you know, I trust the American people. We trust the American people. But how can he show that trust when this is such a secret and insular White House? If they really trust the American people, then they would be more open, more transparent about the way they go about governing. And so I think that's a very legitimate question on your part. There is a certain attitude by many within the White House that the media is a hindrance or a distraction, and certainly the vice president holds great disdain for the media, as we saw even during the hunting accident, which I had to deal with. But, you know, that was one of the things that, from a communication standpoint, I was constantly fighting. Dan Bartlett, who oversaw all communications, was constantly fighting internally. We probably didn't do near enough, but trying to get trying to overcome that attitude internally was difficult at times.
Let's talk about the hunting accident for a minute. How much time elapsed before you had a phone call that there was something brewing?
Well, it was interesting. The first phone call I received was that night. So it was probably Saturday night, shortly after the accident had happened. It was from the Situation Room. But I don't think the person on the Situation Room, and these are military personnel, had all the information on the ground from the vice president's team. And they gave me a call at home. I remember it was starting to snow that night in February here in Washington, and said that there's been a hunting accident in the vice president's party. And my first reaction was, oh, is the person okay? And they said, well, he's being medevaced to a nearby hospital in the area. And my second question was, well, was the vice president involved in this in any way? And the initial response was, no, they didn't believe he was involved in any way. And I said, well, keep me posted and let me know if you hear any more information. Because at that point I said, oh, okay, well, you know, it's maybe not something that we have to deal with right away. But it was interesting that other people were starting to get information later that evening. But apparently none of the communicators were really brought into the loop when that new information was being brought to others, like Karl Rove and the president, Andy Card. It wasn't until early that next morning, that Sunday morning, about 6 a.m., that I received a phone call from Mrs. Bush's chief of staff, Anita McBride. They had been traveling in Europe, and they were on a stopover, I believe in Ireland, a refueling stopover before heading back to the U.S. And Mrs. Bush had learned about it overnight. And to her credit, she was adamant that the vice president got to get that information out to the press now. And Anita, when she called me, she said, has the vice president gotten the information out? And I said, well, what information? And she said that he shot the guy. And I said, it was the vice president. It was my initial reaction, totally surprised by it. Immediately after that, shortly thereafter, I was on the phone with Dan Bartlett, and saying that the vice president's got to get this out to the national media and get it out now. Dan agreed. We thought we could. He didn't have national press traveling with him, so we thought we could do what we had done in other incidents like that, arrange a phone call with a group of reporters, a pool of reporters that could share that information more broadly, where it could be explained exactly what happened. And the vice president took our advice and waited several more hours, and it was 18 hours after the incident that it finally went out to the local paper in Corpus Christi, Texas, and was put on their website, and the national media learned about it from there. It was terribly handled from a crisis communication standpoint, and it raised suspicion that didn't need to be raised over the next few days as I had to defend things, and it wasn't until that Wednesday that the vice president finally went out and did an interview to explain it for himself.
Well, that all sounds so unbelievably Byzantine, Scott, that I have to imagine if I were in your position, I would want to throw the phone across the room when I got the call from Mrs. Bush.
I talk about the disillusionment of the last 10 months. That was another disillusioning moment, and it was extremely frustrating. I remember walking in after my first briefing that Monday, and the vice president's in the Oval Office with the president, and he said, "I thought you did a great job today," and I wanted to say thanks. It's time for you to get out there. And in fact, we talked to the president, and we said the vice president's got to get out there and explain this. He's not providing any of us information. It's tough in that briefing room because I only have a limited amount of information, and I wasn't there. And the president looked at us and said, "Well, you kind of got to make this feel like it's the vice president's idea." And I was looking at him like, "Can't you just tell him to get out there? You're the president." And it took 2 days for that to happen.
You wanted to say it, but you didn't feel like you could.
No, I didn't. I didn't say it at this time. I just kind of shook my head. I thought that maybe he'd bring him around pretty quick, but it was another 2 days before the vice president actually agreed to finally go out there.
Do you think that if you had been sort of older and I don't want to, you weren't that young when you began working for him, but I wonder if had you had 20 years of work experience under your belt before you took on this extremely powerful position, if it would have been easier for you to stand up to the president in certain situations, or if the culture of the way things were meant nobody did that to him?
Well, no, I think some more experience probably would have been helpful. I actually talk about that in the book as well, and certainly the experience that I gained, even though it was painful at times, has enlightened me very much, and I would definitely do some things very differently if I had the opportunity to do them over again. There were times when I would, I was the kind of person that tended to express my views one-on-one with the president rather than in a large meeting. And I didn't hesitate to do that when I thought it was necessary. Did I do it as much as I should have? No. And did I do it as much as I should have on policy issues? No, I wouldn't say so on that either. It was more on the communication side. And I should have been speaking up more on some of the policy, because it was the policies that were most harmful as opposed to the communication side of things. Your communications is only as good as the policy. And to a large extent, any spokesman reflects the leader they're speaking for probably more so than they do themselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. His new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Let's go to Marcus in Carrollton. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. Hey, Scott, you mentioned there briefly the Vice President Cheney. And I'm wondering, when George Bush was governor here, he had a Democratic Congress. The governorship here is a weak governor.
Right.
So he really had to work across the aisle. When he got to the presidency, he had a Republican Congress. So I guess my question is, how much of it is it that we really saw the real George Bush when he made it to Washington, and how much of it was the influence of, like, Vice President Cheney and some of the other people that he surrounded himself with in his new administration?
That's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. The president was willing to try to elevate the discourse and change the tone in Washington to an extent. And we did that a little bit early on with education reform as he worked with Ted Kennedy and other Democrats like Congressman Miller from California, and even on some other issues as well. But I think the president learned probably the wrong lesson from his father's time in office. One of the turning point moments I talk about that poisoned the atmosphere in Washington in a big way was the 1988 campaign, when his father, who's a very civil person in terms of being a leader and governing, was told by his advisors that the only way he could beat Michael Dukakis was to run in a completely negative campaign. And he did, and he won. But the bitterness from that campaign carried over into the governance, and Democrats didn't forget that period, that campaign. And I think it contributed to President Bush 41's downfall, the first President Bush, because he set aside politics to a large extent once he got into office, but others didn't. And the president said, "I'm not going to let that happen to me. This is the way the game's played. Instead of transforming it, I'm going to play the game under the rules as they exist today." So he took away the wrong lesson, and I don't think was deeply in his heart committed to really trying to overcome the poisonous and destructive atmosphere in Washington, D.C. If he had been, he would have made a constant effort to try to change the tone, and he would have been able to acknowledge mistakes in the aftermath of Iraq and embrace things like the Iraq Study Group, the bipartisan Baker-Hamilton approach to bringing the war to an end.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Kyle in Wichita Falls writes, with candidates on both sides of the aisle, even down to the local level, conducting permanent election cycles, this raises several questions. What started this for politicians who should be working in government, not on the campaign trail, and what would the best solution be to end this vicious cycle?
Well, they're actually, that's a great question. I talk about in the last chapter of the book, I talk about some ideas from the executive branch perspective primarily. I mean, the most important thing is that we've got elected officials have got to embrace a high level of candor, and that means openness, that means transparency, it means honesty with the American in dealing with the American people. If you don't have a commitment to that, then it's going to be hard to change the atmosphere otherwise. And I'm encouraged that both presidential candidates have talked about changing the way Washington governs and works. But it's difficult once you get in there if you don't have a plan to do so. And from the presidential standpoint, no one has a bigger bully pulpit or platform from which to change the way Washington governs than the president. And if a president's committed to a high level of candor and openness, first, and then the other aspect I talk about is creating a new position of deputy chief of staff for governing, which would be a statesman or stateswoman-like figure to counterbalance the political side as much as anything else. And that person would focus on making sure that the administration is being transparent and open, making sure that it is constantly reaching out across the aisle to work with Democrats in a bipartisan, deliberative fashion, and engaging in reasoned and rational and honest discussion of the issues versus too much politicization of those issues. And so that's one of the things I talk about. But there are a lot of good ideas out there. Ron Brownstein, a journalist here in Washington, wrote a book and talked about a lot of different ideas from redistricting reform to other ideas that could end this excessive partisanship that is going on in Washington, D.C. Not end it, but minimize it, put it back in its contained place.
Texas native and former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan is my guest. His book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. His new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org. Scott, not many people's sort of resignations are that memorable, but I think many people recall the president talking about you and he sitting out in rocking chairs somewhere, and you've written amusingly that you glanced at him and thought, I'm not that old.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if you could talk about how long it took for it to set in. You know, it seemed quite amiable when it happened. Obviously, you were asked to leave. Can you talk about the process for yourself in terms of really getting your mind around what had happened and how you really felt about your tenure as press secretary?
Right. Well, I mean, two things. I talk about my departure and you know, at some length because, as I mentioned earlier, I was becoming increasingly disillusioned. And by early April, when I learned that the president had secretly authorized the vice president to anonymously leak parts of the intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, it was a turning point for me in the sense that we had been decrying the selective leaking of classified information and for years, including myself and the president, and here he was doing what we had decried. And so I had made the decision that I just could not continue being spokesman when I was being undermined internally. But it was also at a time when we were bringing in a new chief of staff, and the president gave Josh Bolton, the new chief of staff, full authority to do things the way he wanted. And then, you know, the tendency is when your approval ratings as president are as low as they were for this president, they're even lower today, The first place to point for fixing things is the communication side of things, when, instead of looking internally necessarily at the policy. And I understood that. And Josh wanted to make some changes, and I told him that was fine. I was ready to leave anyway. Not at the time that I did, but I was wanted to get by that period, and then I would be announcing my own resignation. But it was a tough period. I mean, I continue to have a lot of personal fondness for the president. I worked for him and worked closely with him for nearly seven and a half years, and knew him longer than that, going back to our days in Texas together. And, you know, it's tough to separate that personal affection you have from a leader like that from his policies and governance and leadership. And that's what I had to do to be able to come to the conclusions that I did, which are the truth as best I know them from my perspective. And that wasn't an easy process. It took stepping outside of the White House to get a different perspective on things. It took the revelations of other things coming to light, whether it was U.S. attorneys or waterboarding and things of that nature after I'd left office, to open my eyes in a new way and to look at things in a clear-eyed way. And the process of writing the book was a tough one. It wasn't easy to write the things that I did, given my personal affection for the president, but I felt it was important to do so if we're going to actually change the way things work in Washington, if we're going to make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes, and if we make sure that we're going to learn from the mistakes that this administration made to go ahead and go forward with this book.
Is he the sort of person who could recognize that it wasn't personal on your part, or is your relationship with him forever shattered?
I hope not. Obviously, I don't expect to speak to him anytime soon. I hope that, and my guess is that Mrs. Bush has already read the book, knowing her. But I hope that someday the president can step back from this when he's out of office, read my book, and understand where I'm coming from. I think when people read the book, they recognize that it's a very serious and thoughtful look at what occurred and where things went wrong and what we can learn from it. And there's nothing personal in it in terms of bitterness or anything of that nature. And so I hope that someday he'll be able to look at that, and maybe someday we can talk about it. And I hope that someday, as he's thinking about or talking about his legacy, that he can come to the realization that come to grips with the fact that things didn't turn out the way he had hoped as well, and come to honestly share his perspective on things.
Mrs. Bush has now come up twice in this conversation, and because she's not actively involved in public policy making, except to a really limited degree with her sort of a couple of pet causes,
right,
many people assume her to be not a great political influence on her husband or philosophical influence. Can you talk about what you know to be the truth in their relationship?
Well, I think she's very candid with him in person. A lot of her advice is she's very protective of him, as any spouse would be, someone who's in that level of political or that at that political level. When you are surrounded by a lot of people and you're not sure what all their motivations are. But she also is someone that's not afraid to tell him what she thinks, and he looks to her for advice. Now, he doesn't always take that advice, but she certainly shares it with him one-on-one, and I think that's across the board on a variety of issues, certainly on her pet causes, as you mentioned, like education reform and things such as providing aid to Afghanistan and women's issues, and aid to Africa as well, are important issues that are near and dear to her, and positive issues that I think the president are issues that have largely been overshadowed because of the other policy, misguided policies that were put in place by this administration.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Richard in Dallas. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, afternoon. I had the opportunity to work with the Small Business Administration Disaster Assistance Division for about 4 years and sort of got to see FEMA from the inside. And regarding Katrina, I think there was an inherent problem there that is probably not easily correctable, and that is most of FEMA's relief efforts are going to be ground-based because they're having to take tremendous amount of supplies, whether it's water, food, housing, tents into a disaster area, and therefore that is going to have to be trucked in to assist, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And I use the scenario, what if they had a major earthquake in California and L.A., and a lot of the bridges and overpasses collapsed and the roads were disrupted? The only way to bring in that relief, as it was with Katrina, was by air, and we do not have enough helicopters or other types of aircraft to bring in those supplies and the quantities needed to the places that are needed when the ground force capability of FEMA is disrupted or basically prevented from entering a city that is destroyed.
Richard, thank you. I'm very glad that you brought up Katrina. We don't have too much time left, so I want to have Scott have a chance to answer to that. So
thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. You do write in the book about the problems that happened right after that, and you describe the White House as being in denial for the better part of a week following the storm.
Yeah, there was a breakdown at all levels of government. In my book, I focus on the breakdown at the federal level, and your caller brings up a very good point in terms of how difficult it is to get supplies in there after a major disaster, particularly one the size of Katrina and its uniqueness with New Orleans in terms of the flooding that went on there. We pre-positioned an enormous amount of supplies before that storm. But with the flooding in New Orleans, it became even more difficult to get those supplies in there. The first priority, obviously, being rescuing people from their homes and their rooftops or the highways, wherever they may have been trapped, those that did not get out ahead of time. And that first week, the president came to the realization, but it took a few days. We almost became complacent because we had been through so much in this administration, through two wars, the 9/11 attacks, of course, four major hurricanes in Florida the year before. And Florida has a great emergency management response in place, and they did a great job that year before. And I think we were under this sense that, well, could be a bad storm, but we didn't really truly believe it would be the worst-case scenario as it turned out to be. And we thought that all the things were being done that had been done for other major hurricanes. But this one was different because of New Orleans and because of the flooding that went on there. And we didn't fully appreciate that this might well be that worst-case scenario and do enough ahead of time or even as it was hitting, getting back to Washington and overseeing things from there as we should have. Now, the president did get on top of things, but it took a few days. And getting back to Washington and holding meetings and cracking some heads before we got there and recognizing that the federal government, and I think most people recognize this, is the fail-proof backstop when the state and local authorities are overwhelmed, as they were in New Orleans in particular. But it took too long for us to come around, and there's more we could have done sooner.
For as long as there have been presidential press secretaries, and I believe you were the 25th to have held that position, presidents have been saying things that caused their staff to wince, every single one of them. But I'm wondering, when you hear comments like, heck of a job, Brownie, when you hear the president there in New Orleans describing all the fun he had partying there as a college student, what's going through your mind as you think, I'm going to have to re-spin this and I'm going to have to divert attention from it, and this is not what I got up to do this morning?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a tough spot, and usually in situations like that, I would talk to the president in the case of heck of a job, Brownie. I mean, it was probably an advanced problem as much as anything else. The president said, well, the guy's standing right next to me as I got there. What am I supposed to do? The cameras are rolling. I'm trying to pump up his morale. And I know it's a tough situation, but I can't ignore him when he's standing there and I'm praising everybody else. And, so he had a little bit of a point there. But, yeah, there were other times when we landed in New Orleans that Friday, I believe it was, he talked about what you said, spending some wild days there in New Orleans. And even earlier in the week when he was walking Mississippi neighborhoods with Trent Lott in Gulfport, and he talked about, rebuilding Trent Lott's house to making it, forgetting about, those that are much less well off than Trent Lott to some extent. It is something that you shake your head at and go, we're going to have to deal with that one, or the president's going to have to clean it up later somehow. But he was very open about listening to that kind of criticism and recognizing he had probably made a mistake in situations like that.
Let's speak next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris and Scott. Scott, as angry as I am with this administration, with you by association, I want to say thank you for, providing truth to us before the end of the administration, before the election. I think it took a lot of courage, and as a citizen, I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, too.
My question has more to do with the future in that, I hope for you this isn't the beginning, or this is only the beginning of, I'll say, a little bit of redemption. I hope that you'll work for transparency in government in the future, no matter who's elected. And I also have a question about Dana Perino. I heard her on an NPR show where she did not even know about the Cuban Missile Crisis. She said she wasn't even born then. My question is, how can someone be that incompetent in that position and, you know, have achieved that level? And it's just still a reflection of this administration not taking the public seriously.
Yeah, you know, she later tried to clarify that. I don't know the full truth. I haven't spoken to her about it. I don't expect I'm speaking to her anytime soon, given current circumstances. But saying that she was just kidding around, it was a lighthearted show, I don't know the full truth about it, but it sure didn't sound good at the time. And I kind of shook my head when I first heard about it. I didn't hear the show, but when I first read about it, I guess, online shortly thereafter. In terms of your question about this being only, first of all, I thank you for your kind words. I've been getting lots of that across the United States from people, not only Democrats, but also some Republicans that are dismayed with things in Washington. It is my view that this is only the beginning. Look, a lot of people write a book like this when they're retiring completely from their careers. I'm 40 years young. I do intend to keep working on the issues I talk about in the book. I don't know in what capacity that will be, whether it's in an academic capacity or some other role. I want to continue pushing forward on these issues. I think it's very important in this presidential election for us to press the candidates, for all people to press the candidates on specifics about how they're going to go about implementing and governing when they're in office, implementing their policies and how they go about governing once in office. They talk a good game now, and they make us believe a lot of things, but it's very difficult once you get in there. And we need to know the specifics so that we can have a high level of trust that they will follow through on exactly what they're talking about.
Well, what an odd position you're in, Scott, because you were involved in one of the most partisan administrations that we have seen in the past half century. And now you've become somewhat a darling of the left. I don't know if you're entirely comfortable with the fact that you're this new hero to Democrats and this sort of dog to a lot of dyed-in-the-wool Republicans.
Well, like I said, it's actually on both sides, I found, when I've been traveling the country, more so to the Democratic side, you're right, and the critics of the administration. Maybe some of this is returning to my roots. I grew up in a Democratic family, switched parties in the mid-'80s, shortly before I became of voting age, when my mother, as many of your listeners are familiar with, switched parties as well. But we've always been a family that has believed in problem-solving and being involved in public service and compromise and building consensus and doing what you can to make a positive difference. And so those values have never left me, and hopefully this book is an extension of those values that I was raised on at a very early age, when my grandfather, the late dean of the University of Texas School of Law, Paige Keaton, used to tell us, it's not the dollars you make, it's the difference you make. And that's something that has always stuck with me and has always stuck with my three older brothers as well. And so I intend to continue pressing forward on some of these issues.
In the 10 seconds we have left, surely the DNC is courting you. Would you consider switching back?
I haven't made any long-term decisions. I'm not ruling anything in or out at this point. Right now, I want to continue focusing first and foremost on how we can improve the way Washington governs and restore some candor and transparency to the political process here in Washington.
Scott McClellan's new book is called What Happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Scott, it's been very interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Chris, I very much enjoyed it. Thank you, and thank your listeners.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.